everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's October 2024, and you're listening to episode 415, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about season 2 of the Amazon Prime series, The Rings of Power. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an online exclusive review article for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called "The Subtle Art of Corruption in the Sophomore Season of The Rings of Power," and you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Cole, it's good to have you back on the podcast.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
Well, today we're doing a deep dive into the second season of Amazon Prime's The Rings of Power, which is a series, an original series, that is telling the backstory to what's more familiarly known to people as his Lord of the Rings series. This is dealing with his appendices and also the Silmarillion. And so a lot of people might not be that familiar. They're familiar with The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, but maybe they didn't get into some of the backstories that were kind of not even really fully realized or finished by the time of J.R.R. Tolkien's death. But I would like you to give us an overview of what The Rings of Power is doing, and specifically the second season, which, of course, really focuses on the big baddie, Sauron.
Yeah, so Rings of Power, just from an overview standpoint, like you noted, is focused on adapting the appendices and parts of the Silmarillion from Tolkien's Legendarium. Now, for people who don't really know what that is, The Lord of the Rings, which is what Tolkien is known for, a book trilogy that came out back in the 50s, The Lord of the Rings were part of a myth cycle, for lack of better wording, that this Christian writer named J.R.R. Tolkien, Catholic writer, was creating. It sort of set the bar for fantasy fiction going forward. If you're familiar with things like Dungeons and Dragons, which sort of comes along and solidifies in the pop culture imagination, quote-unquote fantasy tropes, all of that was sort of rooted in what Tolkien did. And Tolkien drew from a plethora of sources, from old, warrior poetry like Beowulf, to mythology in the Northern European fashion, to his own world experiences in wartime during the First World War. All of those things sort of coalesced in this just great fantasy mythology that he was building in the vein of Lord Dunsany and some other writers who were writing pre-Tolkien, what's called pre-Tolkien fantasy. But Tolkien comes along and sort of codifies what we think of as the modern pop culture tropes with The Lord of the Rings, and this broader setting called Middle Earth. And The Lord of the Rings, even though it's extremely well known as this very popular trilogy, and became even more well known after the Peter Jackson films of the early 2000s, which cleaned house at the Academy Awards and are still very, very much looked upon with high regard. Though that's what's known, Tolkien actually created a lot more. There's a whole sort of expanded universe, if you will. And The Lord of the Rings, that is the book trilogy, is only a small facet of this legendarium that Tolkien created. And so when The Rings of Power, which is the new Amazon show, when The Rings of Power comes along, the showrunners, the creators, wanted to adapt something that we hadn't really seen before. You'd seen The Lord of the Rings has had a lot of different adaptations over the years. But they were interested in leaning into the second age of Middle Earth. So The Lord of the Rings, the books and the movies, take place in the third age of Middle Earth. The second age is before all of that. And in the first season, the show did a lot of work to set up the second age, what it looks like. The second season, which is currently airing, or just, I guess it's wrapped up airing, but it's out there to watch now on Amazon Prime. The second season is focusing in more detail on the character of Sauron. Sauron is, of course, the great and iconic villain of The Lord of the Rings. And this season really sort of delves into the way that he deceives the people of Middle Earth into creating the titular Rings of Power so that he can control them. And that's all to do with the fact that in The Lord of the Rings, the titular rings are these, well, magical rings, if you will, that were forged and grant their wearers great power. But there's also an element of deception. They were forged in deception because of Sauron, who forged them with the intention of using the rings to bend the free people of Middle Earth to his own will. And of course, there's the great forging of what's called the One Ring, which is the ring that Frodo in The Lord of the Rings is tasked with carrying and to Mount Doom and destroying ultimately, which is the ring that sort of controls all the others, which Sauron forged for himself. So the story that's really being told in The Rings of Power is how the rings came to be forged in the Second Age. And the second season in particular begins to really explore the creation of the rings. And then this all leads up to really a sort of, for my money, was a miniature Marvel on television. I don't know that I've ever seen a television series with this kind of scope or budget behind it. There's this sort of 3-episode battle, if you will, during the siege of Eregion, at the conclusion of the season, which is where everything sort of comes to a head. So that's a general overview of the series itself, and then just an overview of the second season and kind of what it's doing.
Well, of course, The Lord of the Rings, both the books and the Peter Jackson trilogy of films, has really been just very popular among Christians over the years, probably because of the Christian worldview behind those books and anything to do with Lord of the Rings, pretty much because of the faith of Tolkien. So The Rings of Power, is that something that Christians can watch? It's not being made by the same people who made the Lord of the Rings films. So I'm not sure if Christians really would be interested in this particular series. I mean, specifically if they're not really big into the whole fantasy genre or are Tolkien fans to begin with.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a show that Christians could watch. You know, this is not Game of Thrones fantasy type stuff. One of the things that I think the show does incredibly well is capture, in a sense, the spirit of Tolkien, if I can say it that way. Even though there are all of these sort of changes that have to take place because it's an adaptation and you're trying to write within a structure of 8 episodes per season, there is still this sense that there's a great respect and reverence for what it is that Tolkien has built. And I think the show does quite a good job of honoring and respecting that. And Tolkien himself said that one should be able to deduce from reading his stories that he is a Christian. And I think that watching the show, you can certainly see how facets of that come out. I don't necessarily think that you could say by the time you get to the end of the second season, this is a thoroughly Christian show. That being said, I think you can see the overt influence of Tolkien's Christianity in the show, much more so than you could a lot of other shows out there. So if the question is, could Christians watch this show? Then I think yes. I think that the Christian could absolutely watch the show and really get something out of it. And if you know you're coming at this from the perspective of cultural apologetics, then I certainly think that the apologist can find a lot here to talk with people about. And you know the show is very widely viewed. It's if I'm not mistaken, it's the number one show on Prime right now, and it's always watched by a wide audience because Lord of the Rings is so well loved. There's a very good chance that you know there are people who aren't necessarily Christians that you know who are watching the show, and that could lead to a lot of interesting on ramps for conversations about the gospel. It's the nice thing about the Lord of the Rings is that it is sort of the low hanging fruit for talking about a pop culture artifact and then steering the conversation to matters of faith and things like that. So, yeah, I think it's a show Christians can watch.
What about younger kids? Like, what is the age, you know, range that you think could watch this show? There are certain, you know, scary elements, I would say. So I don't know. I would say maybe middle school and up, but I think some younger sixth graders, it might be a little too intense for them, because I do think that this show could also be ways in which you could talk about different, you know, aspects of Christian theology with your kids. But I don't know what you think about, since I know you teach at a school, what this would be appropriate for, what age range?
I can completely see a lot of the underclassmen being bored with this show.
Being bored with this show, that's interesting.
Until the last three episodes where it's war. But those initial episodes, at least the beginning, because these are long episodes, right? Pretty much all of them, if I'm not mistaken, run over an hour in length. I don't know that many of my students who, you know, they never talk about the Lord of the Rings. The books are too long. The ones that have read it don't like reading Tolkien's writing. Most of them haven't seen the Peter Jackson movies because it's getting to the point where, you know, the Peter Jackson movies by this point are over 20 years old. It's just not part of the pop culture lexicon in the way that it was 20 years ago because of the Peter Jackson films. And frankly, there are just other shows out there to watch. I mean, they watch the Star Wars shows. They watch the Marvel shows. They're just not really interested in Lord of the Rings. Everybody that I know who is watching The Rings of Power is 30 or over. I don't know anybody under the age of 30 who is watching Rings of Power. Personally, I'm not saying there aren't anybody. I'm just saying I don't know anybody under the age of 30 who is or even brings it up in conversation. So that being said, do I think that younger audiences could watch the show? Yeah, there are some frightening scenes, but that's always been part of the Lord of the Rings. There are some really frightening scenes in the Peter Jackson films. Do I think that students in middle school could watch it? Yes. Do I think that they're going to like it? No. This is definitely a show that I would say you're going to get the most mileage out of if your audience is older children, you know, 16, 17, 18, something like that, and up. It's not The Hobbit. You know, The Hobbit really is sort of a children's story. It's not The Hobbit. It's certainly, I think, a little more In some ways, I think it's a little more violent than Peter Jackson's films, but, you know, most everything television-wise has become more violent in the last 20 years. You know, we've sort of been a little more desensitized to it.
I think the gore is a little bit, the gore and the suggested gore is a little bit more intense.
Yeah, I agree.
In the Jackson films, but I also think that Jackson films, you know, many decades ago, they were amazing for what they are, but the CGI is so much better now. So it just seems a little bit.
It is. I think you're absolutely right. But then again, and I often have to remind myself of this, man, orcs seem to get decapitated left and right in Jackson's movies. It's sort of shocking to me, the levels of some of the violence in those movies when I go back and watch them. But I think you're right. I think there's a lot more suggested stuff in the Rings of Power. And perhaps in some ways it is appropriate. For example, in The Lord of the Rings and the books and the movies, you know, Sauron is, we were talking about this just before we started, Sauron's an eye. he's a tower.
Disembodied.
Yeah, he's disembodied. He's there. He's lurking. But in the Second Age, he's out. He's in the world. He's walking around. And so in some ways, I think the darkness here is appropriate. This is the age that in when you get to the Lord of the Rings, that they're going to be talking about, right? They're going to be talking about as the distant past. You know, this is what it was like when Sauron was around there. And they use these stories to impress upon Frodo the need for the destruction of the ring. You know, you don't know what it was like when Sauron was here and it nearly destroyed Middle Earth and it led to the last alliance of men and elves. And here in the Second Age, we're actually watching that. So I will say that by the end of the second season, things do turn quite dark, maybe surprisingly so. But that is not as dark as it gets, is what I will say.
I also think when it's like, not necessarily the, you know, how Jackson did the disembodied eye, but just the idea of the malevolence of Sauron doesn't seem as where you're struggling with it. It seems like the good and evil is a little bit more binary, black and white, than here, where he's disguised, but we'll talk a little bit more about that later, as something that could be good. So there's a lot of like waffling. And then
yes.
Also, oh, this, we've got to fight this bad guy. So what is quote unquote the lesser of two evils? Should I, as, you know, an elf, you know, ally myself with even maybe this created character Adar because we could, you know, overrules. I mean, it just seems like the choices are a little bit more tense. Not that Frodo didn't have tense choices, but I'm just saying
not really making a pun here, but in a sense, it's very true. Evil just wears a different face in the Second Age than it does in The Lord of the Rings. And it forces a kind of just a different way of dealing with it. Than maybe what most people are used to having just watched The Lord of the Rings.
Do you have something that you'd like to suggest that we cover either in an article or a podcast for the Postmodern Realities Podcast and the Christian Research Journal? Please feel free to contact us at response@equip.org. You can also submit any letters to the editor if you would like to make a comment about our articles at that address, response@equip.org. Now, speaking of cultural apologetics and things that we'd like to cover in this section of the Postmodern Realities Podcast, we have some interesting things coming up, including the prequel to Dune, Dune Prophecy, which will be on HBO later this fall. We are also going to cover the new best-selling book based on Gravity Falls from Disney called The Book of Bill, which is really hitting it big with a lot of Gen Zers regarding that series from their childhood, as well as some of the best-selling books and one that's been made into a TV series from writer Blake Crouch. That is Dark Matter. That's on Apple TV Plus, as well as his most recent bestseller, Upgrade. Now, we just want to thank you for partnering with us by letting people know about this podcast. Please tell a friend And also like, share, and write us a review on Spotify or specifically Apple Podcasts. And that way people can find us and be suggested our content if they're interested in Christian apologetics. Now back to my conversation with Cole Burgett about season 2 of The Rings of Power on Amazon Prime. So we've been kind of talking about the Peter Jackson films and then this particular series. So how is the connection between the two, you know, kind of series? Well, one's TV series, one's a set of movies. But is The Rings of Power really connected to the Lord of the Rings movies, or are they just really separate things? Help us understand that. Because like you said, the younger generation isn't really watching this. And so there might be some people who are Lord of the Rings fans, like, you know, people who are millennials or Gen Xers that want to introduce their kids to the whole Tolkien universe. And so how are they connected or not?
Yeah, this is actually a really fascinating question. So the showrunners have made it very clear that The Rings of Power is its own entity. That is to say, they're not trying to line up the story one-to-one with Peter Jackson's films. That being said, and this really cannot be overstated, the significance of Peter Jackson's films in lending a visual language to Tolkien's Middle Earth is, again, you just can't overstate it. The Lord of the Rings was one of those properties that for a long time was considered unfilmable. You can't adapt it. It's too big. It's too distinct. It's too different. And Jackson comes along with Fran Walsh. Fran Walsh is sort of always the, you know, the undersung other half of that coin. But Jackson and Walsh come along and they create really a marvel that could only have been created with CGI technology. Even though it was rustic 20 years ago, it still holds up remarkably well. The people at Weta who work on this, I mean, they're the industry standard. They're the best. And I would say that the work Jackson did from a visual standpoint is arguably his most important contribution to Middle Earth. When we think of hobbits, we're going to think of the way that Frodo, Sam, Merry, and Pippin were interpreted by Peter Jackson. When we think of Gandalf, we're forever going to see something like Ian McKellen in that role. When we think of the look of Sauron as this dark shadow whose face is lost behind his helmet, think Peter Jackson, you know, and Jackson, of course, was pulling from illustrations and things like that. But what Jackson did in the films was bring a visual language to the fore. Now, why do I say that? Because the question is, how does the show relate to Jackson's films? The simple answer is that, well, it doesn't. It's its own thing. The flip side to that coin is this. I think if you're just watching The Rings of Power, you could go seamlessly into Jackson's movies and it's going to feel about the same. And what I mean is it's going to feel like it's part of the same universe because of the way that the Jackson films influence the visual language of Middle Earth. Everything is that is done in Rings of Power and really just in everything Middle Earth post-Jackson's films, I'm thinking the video games, so on and so forth, is going to be filtered through the Peter Jackson lens, the lens of the films. And so there is, at the very least, a very strong visual continuity from the armor that characters wear to the swords to the design of the elves and their artifacts to the design of the dwarves and their armor and their weapons and their mines, all of that stuff. There's a great, great amount of visual continuity between The Rings of Power and Tolkien's films. That being said, the showrunners are adamant that it's its own thing. But the thing with Peter Jackson's films, even though they change things from Tolkien's novels, they were still very faithful adaptations. So the degree to which you can cross-pollinate, you can watch The Rings of Power and then go into the Lord of the Rings films and sort of see them as different facets of a whole, I think has more to do with the fact that all is sort of a faithful adaptation of the original source material.
Well, now I want to get into the actual content of the series and then kind of end up by asking you how the series has been received. But definitely, I find that this season is darker than the first. And I think it's because really I see this season with a few side trips to, you know, wrap up and check in on other storylines is focused on Sauron. And that's really interesting because we were talking before just about, you know, that Sauron's this evil disembodied force in the Jackson films. But this is a different age of Middle Earth where Sauron was in a physical form and he is crafting these rings that we've heard about, not the One Ring yet that everyone knows about in The Lord of the Rings, but the fact that he is here walking amongst in different bodies, I guess. And he was in the first season, but this one is basically focused on him. So how is Sauron portrayed in this season? And how did Tolkien envision Sauron? And I did want to say this is because some Christians have assumed that the Chronicles of Narnia and the Lord of the Rings are the same. So they look at the Lord of the Rings as kind of an allegory for a Christian story, which it really isn't. It's more infused with a Christian worldview. So that might be helpful for Christians to understand because they might say, oh, is Sauron supposed to be Satan in this story?
Yeah, that's a good distinction to make. And Tolkien himself was always, he never liked the idea of allegory, right? He was very adamant that this was not an allegory. That being said, if the question is, well, is Sauron this universe's version of Satan, then the short answer is, well, yeah, it's pretty clear. But again, it's not really an allegorical tale, though it is definitely suffused with Christian iconography, themes, etc. So Sauron in The Rings of Power, the first season, and you mentioned just a second ago the way that some people have received it. The first season caught some flack for introducing Sauron in the form of a human named Halbrand, who was not in Tolkien's anything. He was not in the appendices or anything like that. What we do know from Tolkien's Legendarium is that Sauron appeared to an elven smith named Celebrimbor as a... he comes in the appearance of an elf or a messenger of the Valar. The Valar are the powers of Arda, or the ruling entities of Middle Earth who are in subordination to the ultimate creator, Eru Iluvatar, in Tolkien's world. So very complicated mythology there. But if you're a fan, you know. So Sauron appears to Celebrimbor as a messenger of the Valar, sort of this divine messenger, and calls himself Annatar, or the Lord of Gifts. And it is in this disguise, in what is called Sauron's fair form, in this disguise, he begins to manipulate Celebrimbor into crafting the rings. So Sauron, in the second season of The Rings of Power, has to get to that form. So he starts off as a human, Halbrand, continuing on from the first season. But in this season, he is transformed into Annatar. And it's done in a very dramatic fashion. And it's done in such a way as to clearly manipulate Celebrimbor into thinking that maybe this guy really is a messenger of the Valar, that he is this sort of divinely appointed angel, for lack of a better word. I mean, you know, angel, Greek, messenger, so literally an angel. This messenger who is sort of seeking to work with him to forge these rings of power to save the elves and to help the dwarves and to, you know, spare men and that kind of a thing. So Sauron is portrayed, I would say faithfully here, as a master manipulator. The brilliance of the character of Sauron, indeed, even the genius of Tolkien, is this is not Darth Vader. You know what I mean? Vader, who is just, you know, and Vader's portrayal over the years has changed slightly. But Vader is sort of seen as just this force who imposes his will upon others. He storms in, chokes people, that kind of a thing. Sauron is different. Sauron represents I would argue, a far more mature understanding of evil, which is that evil rarely forces itself when it doesn't have to. It seduces. It plays in the realm of half-truths. One of the great horror films that I've talked about before on this podcast, Robert Eggers' film, The Witch. The Witch has one of the most effective portrayals of Satan I've ever seen. I remember I watched this movie in a theater when I was in Bible college, and I was having a horrible day. I went to the theater, watched this movie, and I walked out, and my day was better after watching this horror film, because it was so clear-eyed in its portrayal of Satan. And it literally is Satan in the film. It goes something like this. You can watch the entire film, The Witch, and there are all of these hints throughout that there's a supernatural presence. But you can watch the movie straight through and come to the conclusion that, oh, there was never a supernatural presence. This was just a family that got lost in the mazes of their own hysteria and came apart at the seams, until you get to the last 5 minutes of the movie where Satan literally shows up. And what he does so brilliantly, what Eggers does so brilliantly in that movie, is very similar to the way Tolkien portrays Sauron. Eggers has Satan come in only once everything in this particular character's life has been shattered. And he never comes in, he never overrides. But what he does is he steps in at the end after she's got nothing left, and he offers her the world. I will give you everything. So that because she is now sitting in a hell of her own making, she has nothing left to do but say yes. Of course she's going to take his offer, because she has nowhere else to go. And he didn't have to do anything. He just pulled a few strings here or there, and then he gets them to give themselves over to him. That is essentially how Sauron functions in Tolkien's stories and in the Rings of Power, especially this season. He does a few parlor tricks. He sets himself up to be this divine messenger being. But everything that Celebrimbor does, every little compromise that Celebrimbor makes, is still a choice that Celebrimbor makes. That's what's sinister about Sauron. That's what's genius about the portrayal. The realization that Celebrimbor has at the end of the season, and it makes him a truly, truly tragic character. And you know, Charles Edwards, I mean, you know, he deserves awards for the acting performance as Celebrimbor. Celebrimbor realizes that every little compromise he made was a compromise that he made. And he even admits to Galadriel at the end, he knew there was something about this character, Annatar, that he was suspicious of from the very beginning. But because of his pride, because of his ambition, all of these different things, he justified to himself that what he was doing was right. And he shoved aside all of those little hiccups, all of those little wrinkles that told him something just wasn't right. And Sauron never overrides the will, but he, through the power of suggestion, they even have a conversation about halfway through the season. If you remember this scene where Celebrimbor is talking to Annatar and he sort of catches what he's doing. It's a very interesting scene. I can't really remember which episode it was. It was about midway through the season. He catches what he's doing and he says, this is your power. And if I remember the scene correctly, it sort of catches Annatar by surprise. He doesn't quite understand where Celebrimbor is going. And Celebrimbor says, you have this ability where, and this is my paraphrase, of course, you have this ability where you put a thought into someone's head, but then you make them think that they come up with the thought on their own. At this point, they're still sort of talking as friends. It's a little bit of like friendly banter back and forth. But that's exactly what Sauron is doing. He's planting these little seeds and thoughts in Celebrimbor's head and just letting Celebrimbor's ambition and pride, so on and so forth, run with it. And he really doesn't have to do anything. If the question is, what does Sauron do this entire season? He walks around. I mean, that's really what he does. He just sort of walks around. He has some intense dialogue with a few different characters, but he's pretty much just in Eregion. He's pretty much just there in the forge with Celebrimbor. He pretty much just has some conversations and doesn't really do anything for a solid 6 out of the 8 episodes. So the portrayal, I think, is it's very much the Sauron that Tolkien envisioned when writing the character.
Now, you've alluded to this just about how things are subtle, even in your example of the other film, the Eggers film, The Witch. And actually, you're talking about a character named Celebrimbor. I do want you to just explain who Celebrimbor is so that some people who are not familiar with The Lord of the Rings or Tolkien's work could know how he fits into this story, because the story really is focused on Celebrimbor and Sauron this season. And do you think with showing this corruption in the way that the series makers, the writers and so forth do, is something that Christians might find distasteful? I mean, is it too dark for them? And actually, as I was thinking, as I was watching this series, I thought it was really interesting, because it seems to me that the way in which they're portraying Sauron as Annatar is exactly how in the Bible demons and Satans are portrayed. It's not that they're so revulsive. It's that they are so subjective and they just lie. I mean, he's the father of lies, right? Satan's the father of lies. So he'll just lie and twist into, you know, suggesting to Christians themselves as we fight the spiritual battle, things that we are already considering, and just whisper lies to us. So is that going to make Christians feel a heaviness? Like, oh, should I watch this series just the way that evil is being portrayed here?
So my usual go-to response, right, for something like this is to say, look, it doesn't really matter what you're watching. Different people are going to get different mileage out of just different things in general. So if you're watching something that is violating your conscience, then at that point, you should probably stop watching it. That being said, do I foresee the portrayal of Sauron in The Rings of Power as being that for people? No, I don't. At least not widespread. I will also offer the caution that if the reason a Christian stops watching something like this is because they struggle to have a capacity for evil in the world, you know, what we have to encourage against is this sentimental view of the Christian life, this sort of airbrushed version of the Christian life. You have to be able to account for evil. You have to be able to look at evil in the face and name it for what it is. As a Christian, it's especially important as a Christian, who are supposed to be clear-eyed to do this. So I would say if the reason that one looks at a character like Sauron and his portrayal and says, oh, I can't watch this, it's too demonic, it's something like that. If the reason they come to that conclusion is because in their theology, there is just not a room for dark things, if there's not a room for evil, then there's probably, you know, a facet of the theology there that needs to be buttressed just a little bit. There's probably a facet of theology there that needs to be sanded down and really refined into something a little stronger, because evil is real and it must be dealt with. And Sauron as a character, created by a Christian no less, is a very good example of the pervasiveness of evil. If the response to realizing that evil is subtle is to shut your eyes and pretend it's not there, then you're the prime target. You're the person it's going after. You probably have some bigger problems. But there's a sort of maturity and wisdom even that comes with recognizing that evil is in fact subtle, that the best laid plans are oftentimes laying the groundwork for evil to take hold. You get that wonderful little exchange between Elrond and another character early in the season. He's the elf mentor whose name escapes me at the moment, that he goes to see, and then he just sort of disappears from the story. But you get that wonderful little dialogue between them, I think at the beginning of the second episode, where Elrond really has a serious problem with the rings. He does not trust them. And he's talking to this mentor character who more or less says to him, you know, it has to be tempered with humility. And that's often overlooked, right? We often talk about wisdom. We don't talk enough about humility. The antidote in Tolkien's world to power, the antidote to evil, is humility. And so the subtleness of evil, right, the temptation to evil in Tolkien's world, and you see this in the Rings of Power, is rebuffed by someone who is humble. You see this with Tom Bombadil, which is another character we're going to have to talk about eventually, but it's humility. So, and this contrasts, of course, with Celebrimbor. Celebrimbor, who is the furthest thing from humble that you can possibly find. Celebrimbor, to answer your question, is an elven smith. Some say he's the greatest of all elven smiths, and that has gone to his head, because Celebrimbor wants to be greater than Fëanor. Fëanor, in Tolkien's Legendarium, Fëanor was the great elf king who forged the Silmarils. Now, if you're going, I have no idea what you're talking about. It's simple. The Silmarils were, you know, the objects that lend their title to the Silmarillion, Tolkien's book. The Silmarils are these jewels, these three really sort of brilliant jewels that are forged by Fëanor. Fëanor, who is considered to be the greatest of all elven smiths. And the Silmarils supposedly captured the light of the two trees of Valinor. So it's all very, you know, it's very heady. It's very fantasy-esque, right? But the Silmarils play a central role in the Silmarillion, which really is, like, for lack of a better word, the creation account for Tolkien's world. It's the creation of the whole universe. It's the beginning of the ages of elves and dwarves and men and that kind of thing. So Celebrimbor sort of has this desire to be greater than Fëanor. I don't know if you caught it, but in the Three Rings of Power, that's actually one of the things that Sauron tempts Celebrimbor with. He basically says to him, you know, best Fëanor, surpass Fëanor, become greater than he ever was by forging these rings. So Celebrimbor is a very great and powerful elven smith who's very well respected, but he has a horrible, horrible ambitious streak that ultimately becomes his own undoing.
Also, to give our listeners who are not, you know, deep into the nerddom of the Lord of the Rings, this particular series is taking place in what's called the Second Age. There's the First Age of Middle-earth, Second Age, and Third Age, and the very famous, most known part of the history of Middle-earth is the Third Age. That's when Bilbo Baggins finds the ring in The Hobbit, and then, of course, the trilogy of The Lord of the Rings, where the Hobbit, Frodo Baggins, sets off to destroy the ring. So right now we are in the Second Age. And so part of the Second Age and also the story is at the height of the Dwarven Kingdom. Because by the time we get to the Lord of the Rings, everything's dead in the mountain. And this shows it when all the dwarves were there and working. But things in the second season are seeming to now go a little bit south for them. They are not able to get some sun to grow their crops and so forth. So one of the main characters is Durin, and he is the son of King Durin, who's one of the dwarves, and he's having some real problems, conflict with his dad. So how do Christians look at what's happening with the elves? And I think over this entire series, how can we talk about what the effects of sin are? Because we see that in these rings. They're not the One Ring that we're so familiar with Gollum and all this, my precious. But this idea where these rings, once they're on the wearers, even when the rings of the elves are on them, there's something about them that's not quite right. Some kind of, I don't know, evil, temptation, something. And so we see kind of the effects of what we would call sin enter into this story, really portrayed in the story quite a bit.
Yeah, so you mentioned the dwarves. Great little subplot there in the show following the character of Durin. Durin the Third, which is the king, the dwarf king, and his son Durin. The story that we follow there is essentially King Durin's descent into madness. So he is given one of the dwarven rings forged by Celebrimbor with Annatar, you know, aka Sauron's help. When he puts on the ring, it gives him immense power, but it also amplifies his desire, which his desire is not horribly misguided from the beginning. He's, you know, seeking a way to preserve his legacy, seeking a way to preserve his kingdom. He's seeking a way to expand the dwarf kingdom. And they're mining essentially Mithril. And the ring, which Mithril is used in the rings, the ring is sort of leading him to this great deposit, a deposit in Khazad-dûm, which is the mountain where they live. It's leading him to this deposit, and he's sort of willing to take it at any cost. And the other Durin, his son, who is friends with Elrond, that Durin sort of has to witness his father's descent into madness and come to grips with the fact that this ring is not good. And then, of course, you get in the second season the awakening of the Balrog, which is very iconic. The Balrog is the character from, I guess if you can call it a character, the creature.
The beast.
The beast from the original stories, but perhaps most well known for the Fellowship of the Ring, the Jackson film. It's the creature that's sort of this giant flaming smoke monster, rock monster, that is very much a kind of demon. And this,
it looks like a demon. They have it look like a demon.
Yeah. And this show, which again, you know, taking the visual cues from Jackson's films, introduced the Balrog with the character of King Durin. So that's sort of the dwarf plot. And what I think that plot does very well is it brings the sin close to home, if you will. Durin the Younger, Durin has to find a way to balance his relationship with his wife and his relationship with his father, even while knowing that something is wrong with his dad, and he's not quite sure what it is. But he starts to get a pretty good idea, and he figures it out. And the season sort of builds to this, you know, wonderful confrontation between them, where he sort of has to put his foot down regarding the ring. And so it raises some interesting questions about the effects of sin on the family, because King Durin is very much a character who is what you could say is unrepentant with the ring on. You know, he does not see this as a problem. And then when the problem is raised to his face, he sees it as necessary for the practicality of it all. That's also something this season does extremely well, is it actually shows how many characters sort of wave away, quote unquote, the right thing to do because the solutions are frankly just practical. There's no doubt that the ring is leading him to a trove of mithril that could do all that he's hoping for it to do. But along the way, it means alienating his family and awakening a Balrog. So, you know, maybe not the best thing to do there. But it does sort of bring the question of sin closer to home. It brings the question of how to do the right thing in the right way closer to home. So I think that's a very important little subplot there, the dwarves.
I also want to tell people that I was thinking about this as I was watching the series and we were talking about Satan. And in scripture, in 2 Corinthians, it says that Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. And so it's no surprise if his servants, the demons, also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. So it's interesting, demons and others, as servants of something good. And it's really interesting because I think that's kind of what Sauron does in taking on this elven-like form.
Yeah,
he's a shapeshifter.
Absolutely.
To disguise himself and also deceive Celebrimbor while he's feverishly, you know, working on the rings. You know, Sauron uses his power so that when Celebrimbor goes outside, he just sees happiness and beauty and everyone is running around playfully. But really what he's not seeing is what's happening is his entire kingdom is being sieged by orcs.
Yeah. And I like to be careful when, again, drawing the parallels between Sauron and Satan, especially on these languages.
Yes, I don't think Sauron is a, because Sauron also wasn't the main evil character. There was somebody before
right.
the creation
yeah.
of Middle Earth.
Yep.
Was that?
You have all of that, Morgoth. You have all of that.
Morgoth.
And there's in some ways, there is a great chasm between an ancient Near Eastern, let's say, biblical view of what we think of as demons or spiritual beings. We could do a whole episode just on that, which is very different from the way that we conceive of you know, a demon today, which is rooted in Hollywood and The Exorcist and all that kind of stuff, or even angels, which is influenced by Renaissance paintings and Catholic theology and that kind of stuff. But that being said, it's very true that I think Tolkien was intentionally paralleling, maybe not as an allegory, but paralleling a lot of Sauron with his understanding of Satan. Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, just the themes of evil being able to corrupt, but also being presented to us sometimes as something that's good when it's not, and it's something that's being suggested based on our own sinful desires. And we're talking about Durin, his greed, his wanting to dig where he shouldn't just out of trying to, he thought he was trying to leave a legacy, but in fact, he was beginning the ending of their kingdom without knowing it. As we look what happened in the second age to the dwarves versus the third age. Well, one of the big spoiler, if you don't want to hear one of the major spoilers, then please turn off this episode and come back to it later, is this entire series isn't the stranger Gandalf. And I guess they're suggesting he got his name because it's an amalgamation of good elf or something like that, giant elf, and oh, this is Gandalf. So were you surprised that the stranger was Gandalf? It's such a different portrayal of his origin story versus how we see him in the Peter Jackson films.
Surprise, no. Only because the first season had a pretty jagged twist at the very end of it, where you're sort of teased along the way to think that the stranger could be this new form of Sauron. But then the twist in the first season, and even there are characters even in the show who get this wrong, who think that this stranger is Sauron, only to realize that, oh, Sauron's actually Halbrand disguised as a human, and the stranger is an Istar or Gandalf. One of the wizards, one of the great wizards. So no, I think it was teased pretty well. And I don't know that it comes as a huge surprise to people, but I certainly think it comes as a relief.
One of the characters that's introduced in season two of The Rings of Power is a character that I first came across in the Fellowship of the Ring book in the series by Tolkien, Lord of the Rings. And I have a fun story about that character. When my now oldest son in his 20s was little and the movies were coming out, he wanted to see them. And I said, well, you have to read the book first. Of course, I think he was in first or second grade. He's too young. But at that time, he listened to a lot of books on tape. And so he listened to 21 hours unabridged of The Fellowship of the Ring. And then when we went to see the movie, the first question when we came out of the movie was, where was Tom Bombadil? Why was Tom Bombadil not in this film? So Tom Bombadil is introduced in this season two of the series. And so tell us a little bit about Tom Bombadil, who has some interactions with the stranger, and let us know who he is and what about him.
So the character of Tom Bombadil, played in the second season by Rory Kinnear, very interesting casting choice, but I think a very inspired one. The character of Tom Bombadil is sort of an enigma in Tolkien's world, a legendary enigma. He never showed up in the Peter Jackson films, and I understand why. So in The Fellowship of the Ring, so this is the Lord of the Rings Third Age, Frodo and the crew encounter this character named Tom Bombadil. And Tom Bombadil is sort of this hermit who lives sort of out on his own with his wife, and he is unfazed by the ring's power. When Frodo presents him the ring, he literally just laughs it off and couldn't care less about it. And what makes Tom Bombadil so striking is that he's the only character who does not have this visceral reaction, this fear-type reaction to the ring, or this temptation to the ring. He is wholly removed from it and couldn't care less about it. Tom Bombadil didn't appear in Jackson's adaptation simply because he's a character with no narrative agency, and I get that. If you're trying to write a story, he is not the most compelling character because he's not going to build the drama. In fact, he is going to deflate the drama as soon as he shows up. The thing is, that's the point. That's the point of the character. And Tolkien himself was notorious for not actually being forthcoming about who or what Tom Bombadil actually was in his works. And people have speculated for almost a century at this point over the character of Tom Bombadil. Who is he? What is he? But suffice to say that he is a representation of something very important, an important facet of Tolkien's theology. Again, the way that you beat evil in Tolkien's world is humility. Humility. And Tom Bombadil is perhaps the most humble character Tolkien ever created. He simply doesn't care about ambition. He simply doesn't care about power. And that is his greatest strength. So in the second season of The Rings of Power, Tom Bombadil is introduced. Very good portrayal, very accurate portrayal, I would say. But he is given a little more narrative agency. He's sort of introduced as a character who has to help the stranger realize that he is Gandalf, that he is this great wizard. He is a catalyst, if you will, in the stranger's journey, rather than just someone who they happen across. And a lot of his lines are lifted straight from the Fellowship of the Ring. And so it lends a kind of credibility to the performance. It lends a kind of, let's say, authenticity to the performance, because even though he's saying lines from the Fellowship of the Ring, we've never really seen him say them in adaptations that everybody knows before. So it's very new to us. And Rory Kinnear just did a great, great job with the character. So yeah, Tom Bombadil, fascinating little character. And it's sort of nice to see him finally get his due.
One of the major plot points of both the first and second seasons of The Rings of Power is a place called Numenor, which is a kingdom of men that's near the ocean. So what is the significance of the Numenoreans? How are they connected to the elves? And specifically, what are some of the main characters that are part of this particular story that come out of Numenor?
Yeah, so Numenor. Numenor is this island kingdom that is more or less Tolkien's version of Atlantis in his Legendarium. It's by the Third Age, it's this great island kingdom of men that has since sunk into the sea. But it plays a very important role in a lot of ways. And, you know, it may not be necessarily clear to people why we're following the Numenorean story right now, but it will become clear later. And I think in the second season especially, it becomes clear when Elendil actually wields the Flame of the West, Narsil, the great sword. Elendil is a character who is an ancestor of the character of Aragorn from The Lord of the Rings. Elendil and his son Isildur. So if you're familiar with the movies, the Peter Jackson films, at the very beginning of those movies, the flashbacks, they're not really flashbacks, but the montage that shows you what happened in the last alliance of men and elves when they go to war with Sauron, the character of Isildur, who defeats Sauron and takes the ring, and who is an ancestor of Aragorn. Aragorn is Isildur's heir, and that makes him the rightful king of Gondor. All of those characters we see in the Rings of Power, and they form the crux of the Numenor plotline. So the characters to really watch on the Numenor side of things, the character of Elendil and Isildur, his son. Again, Numenor's story is one of tragic ambition. It's very fitting thematically with the ideas at play in the show. Numenor, again, this island kingdom that is essentially destroyed by its own ambition. Again, it's Tolkien's version of Atlantis, if you will. But the Numenoreans, the men, because they are men, the Numenoreans are men, are the ancestors to Aragorn, to the men of Gondor, who are sort of the main people, humans, in The Lord of the Rings. And that's how that fits in.
Well, finally, on a fun note, I have a rapid fire question for Cole. And so, Cole, out of all of the Tolkien books, what is your favorite? Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, The Silmarillion, something else?
That's a tough question. I'm probably going to say The Silmarillion, personally.
Well, that's probably not someone's expected.
I know.
That's a deep dive into a lot of lore. So thank you for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 415 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Cole Burgett, who has written an exclusive online feature review article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called The Subtle Art of Corruption in the Sophomore Season of The Rings of Power, and you can read it for free at equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.